Curtis Lewa.
Two young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Lewa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Lewa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Lewa from WAPC Radio.
Curtis Lewa, legendary New York.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Lewa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Freeze frame. Freeze frame. Freeze frame. Now freeze. Now I'm looking at a flashback Sunday.
7 minutes after the hour 5. Classic song of the J. Giles Band. Freeze frame. And with the passing of Jay Giles, I think he died at his home in Massachusetts sometime yesterday. It sort of reminded me, freeze frame, if we take you back to the 18 months of that rigorous, endless campaign that was waged to determine who would become our president of the United States. First, it was candidate Donald Trump fighting through, 17, 18 Republican challenges. And he was aggressive, but he was different than the other Republicans. He was saying on a regular basis, hey, we got to try to befriend Putin in Russia. And we got to look to see who are our allies in battling ISIS. That's our main nemesis. And if it means we can let Putin and Assad do the heavy lifting, so be it. And then all of a sudden, a change that has me going through political vertical. Yeah, I'm spinning like a whirling dervish. Yeah, and I know many people out there, including some who have supported Trump all throughout the campaign and in his initial stages of the presidency. They themselves have vertigo on this issue because just yesterday, while sitting with Maria Bartiromo of the Fox Business Channel, he was talking about Assad and Putin.
Frankly, Putin is backing a person that's truly an evil person. And I think it's very bad for Russia. I think it's very bad for mankind. It's very bad for this world. But when you drop gas or bombs or barrel bombs, they have these massive barrels with dynamite and they drop them right in the middle of a group of people. And in all fairness, you see the same kids, no arms, no legs, no face. This is an animal.
That was yesterday and today. Tillerson, back-to-back, belly-to-belly, our Secretary of State, met with the Russians again. And this time, I think, had about a two-hour sit-down with Vladimir Putin himself. On the line to discuss these many changes is Scotty Nell Hughes. She's of Right Alert, and she's been intrepid in her support of Donald Trump as the candidate. And obviously, Donald Trump what is a little less than the first 100 days of his presidency. Thanks for joining us on the Drive Home at 5 again, Scotty.
Thanks for having me. And I love the idea of you saying that you've got basically political vertigo from this whole entire past 2 to 3 weeks of what's been going on with our international policy. But let me give you a little dose of, I guess, what is it, iodine that you give for vertigo to try to calm your nerves and try to balance you out. If you're going to look at the attack on Syria as just an attack on Assad, then I could see where your head's spinning, because we can show pictures of all around the world. We can show what happened in Egypt on Sunday. Just horrible, horrific events that dictators and groups of people are doing to children, men and women, innocent residents of their own country. That was one part of it. But I think the bigger part, I think this was the long game of why we did drop 59 Tomahawk missiles on top of this Air Force base, was more to send the message to all crazy, evil dictators around the world, most importantly to our friend in North Korea, who has decided that we cannot predict him, has decided he's going to throw up a bomb every chance he gets, that there's been a regimen change on our part, that there's no longer a guy drawing red lines in the sand with his new box of crayons. This is someone we have a new sheriff who's saying, I have no problem dropping all of these on you at midnight to clean you out, and I'm not going to give you a calling card and give you a warning like the past administration did. I think that is the bigger picture. So when it comes to Syria, I just advise you and anyone else right now that's trying to figure it out, just put a pause on it for your own sanity, and let's see what his next step is. Is he going to go down the neocon road, or is he going to go another way?
Right. But this is everything he campaigned against. He said, we do not any longer, we should no longer be doing interventions in the Middle East. if the Russians want to come along and do the heavy lifting and kill more ISIS members, so be it. We should be allied with them in that capacity, and so be it with Assad. In fact, just a few weeks ago, it was Spicer himself who said, hey, you know, we're going to have to learn to live with Assad if it's the people of Syria who have to make the determination of his future leadership. How did you mean to tell me one chemical bombing suddenly changed 18 months of a campaign?
That's why I'm telling you, it did not. I don't think we've changed our policy. I don't think we're, you know, unless, I don't have the crystal ball. I'm not sitting privy to those meetings. I am hoping he does not go down the neocon road at this point and engages us more in Syria. I don't necessarily think that's a good thing. But that's not been his policy. I think he was more trying to send a message to the world, not necessarily with this example. It was an excellent opportunity for the president to show the world, and it's not a difference. He's always said strength, through peace through strength, and this was an opportunity. You have a very minimum in casualties, but you had a cause and you had an effect. And I think he showed every other dictator around the world, you try this, I'm going to lash out against you, especially if I feel like it might be a potential danger to the United States.
Well, Scotty Nelyus, at the time that he made the final decision to launch the 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles at that Syrian air base, he was having dinner with the, I'll call him the Red Chinese dictator, although they call him the president. And this is what he had to say about the tension that he thought would exist. And then what the president said was the cooperation from the Red Chinese dictator.
So he paused for 10 seconds. And then he asked the interpreter to please say it again. I didn't think that was a good sign. And he said to me, anybody that uses gases, you could almost say, or anything else, but anybody that was so brutal and uses gases to do that to young children and babies, it's okay.
He agreed.
He was okay with it. He was okay.
And in fact, the Red Chinese president has not gone on record as saying that. As soon as he arrived back in Beijing, the press, the Red Chinese press, which is controlled by the government, were just attacking Donald Trump for being jingoistic, interventionist, militaristic. So why should we believe the president that the Red Chinese dictator was on board here when it seems every indication is that he is opposed to it?
Well, and the key is when we're talking about, I mean to take this tongue in cheek, you could just imagine, say, hey, by the way, can you pass the mashed potatoes? And I just bombed Syria. You can imagine how the conversation went. At that time, that was the proper response for, I think, the Chinese. That would be anybody. But what Trump was sending also to the Chinese dictator is, I'm not afraid of you. I'm going to stand up to you. What you're doing right now on the island in the sea outside your country, I'm not a fan of. And I think that right there, now he might have had time to talk to his consultants or his other folks in government, and there's where you're seeing this change of policy. But at that exact moment it was happening, I think if those comments were made, and nobody has refuted them that they have it, there were other people at the table. At that exact time, I think the Chinese president went, oh my goodness, this is a different president than I've had to deal with the last 8 years, and he was sincerely scared. And that was the right reaction.
And now that we've moved our naval fleet closer to the shore of North Korea, do you anticipate at some point that the president will give another order to fire Tomahawk missiles, cruise missiles, or drop normal kinds of bombs from aircraft on North Korean nuclear weapons bases?
Well, I don't know, because I'm not privy to those security meetings. We don't know just how crazy. The problem that I see with North Korea is we're dealing with a leader who has an ego, who is ignorant, and most importantly, he doesn't abide by the traditional rules of warfare. And that is very dangerous. You're dealing with a crazy lunatic. And so I think the escalation right now, as we're going into a holiday where they're known to do things usually to signify their holidays, I think the president's being prepared for whatever is going to be, whatever he feels like possibly might be coming. But right now we've got to back, you know, that was the one thing. That message was a clear message to the little boy ruler in North Korea right now. You try something with me, I guarantee we will win. So don't go there. And that, I think that's the only way that you back down a bully is by showing them that you're the stronger force than they are.
Do appreciate that. Scotty Nelyus has been defending Donald Trump ever since he jumped into the race, what seems to be a lifetime ago. She's also a Right Alert.
I will mention that the evil seed of Kim Jong, mentally ill, behind the kimchi curtain of North Korea, seems to be welcoming this. It's sort of like, you know, when you're a Rottweiler, big dog, there's a little poodle barking. You generally tend to ignore it. Well, then you just gobble up that little poodle and you shred it to smithereens. Except it's not quite that easy when it comes to the evil seed of Kim Jong, mentally ill, behind the kimchi curtain of North Korea.
Curtis Sliwa.
The next mayor of the city of New York.
The Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
77 WABC.
As we continue on the drive home at 5, one of my favorite topics to riff about is the geriatric espresso-sipping psychotic killers of organized crime. And another one bites the dust. He is a sfachin, or was, a schifosa, and I hope he went straight to hell without an asbestos suit. Now, who am I talking about? I'm talking about Detective Stephen Caracappa, who was teamed up with Eppolito, and they were the two cops who are under contract to the underboss of the Lucchese crime family, Anthony Gaspipe Queso. You may have actually seen his ghoulish house. I remember looking across the Patica Basin from Canarsie and said, hey, what kind of a Wanima would live in a house like that? Right over there on Mill Basin. That was Gaspipe Queso. He was completely off the hook. And they had been under contract and had been paid $375,000 to put hits, murder contracts out on mostly Gambino guys that were at odds with the Lucchese's at that time. I can remember in 1986, these two cops used inside information that they got at One Police Plaza, and they took James Heidel, an associate of the Gambino crime family, brought him the Gaspipe Queso himself, and I think he cut his arms off, he cut his legs off, he killed him horribly. And then they also murdered another Lucchese member. It was an internal dispute, Bruno Facillo, with the assistance of Casso himself because they suspected him of being an informant, a rat. And at the murder scene, the cops reported that there was a stuffed canary right in the mouth of Facciola, which was considered to be a message to other informants that snitches get stitches and end up in ditches. But there were two contracts that Caracappa, Detective Caracappa and Eppolito never fulfilled. They had retired to Las Vegas, and they were being wine-dined and pocket-lined by the mobsters out there and going to the strip clubs where they were getting the brumskis and the lap dancers, and they were getting sex on demand. And then all of a sudden, they got a call from Frankie Lastorino, one of the most powerful members of the Lucchese crime family, and they wanted them to come back to New York City to put a whack on John Gotti Jr., my enemy of all enemies. And they wanted them also to whack little Nick Carrazza, who had grown up with me in Canarsie, was in charge of the Gambino crew that got the contract to whack me and did it gladly on the orders of John Gotti Sr., transferred to them by John Gotti Jr. In fact, they used to have a little clubhouse over on 92nd Street and Avenue L. The Lucchese's were on one side, Paulie Vario, and on the other side was little Nick Carrazza. Now, if these two guys, these two cops who had gone bad, who were under contract, the Gaspipe Queso of the Lucchese crime family, had come back and put two bullets in the back of John Gotti Jr.'s head, they would have saved me a lot of grief and would have saved me a lot of time spent convalescing in the hospital on a number of occasions because of the five hollow point bullets that on John Gotti Sr. to John Gotti Jr.'s orders were given a little Nick Carrazza, who gladly took his main hitman, who is a guy who grew up not far from me in Canarsie, who ended up pumping five hollow point bullets in my lower extremities in the back of that cab in 1992. Now, they had also been contracted to kill Sammy the Bull Gravano, who is considered the rat of all rats eating the Parmesan cheese, especially after he went into a witness protection program in 1992 after testifying against John Gotti Sr. And you know what that led to. Triple life without parole at Marion, where eventually throat cancer took him away. The Grim Reaper took him away. And I couldn't think of a more torturous death that he should have suffered, John Gotti Sr. But they never executed that contract. They were going to end up going out to Phoenix and look for Sammy the Bull Gravano, who was then installing pools in North Phoenix under a completely different name. He was back in business, legal business, but as you know, eventually he ended up getting involved in drug trafficking out there in Phoenix after seeing what the kids were involved with, which is taking ecstasy. That's why he's still doing time as a result of that drug conviction. But Eppolito, unfortunately, is still alive. His mutt, his scale partner. Imagine, these two guys who disgraced the bag of the NYPD. Caracappa is dead, and I'm dancing on his grave. I can't wait till Eppolito drops dead and goes straight to hell without an asbestos suit also.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away.
Gotta hate
if
you, Brian Mondaluch.
You hipster
with your male pun and your skinny jeans. You know I hate Frank Sinatra. So he's just trying to get under my skin. So maybe I'll have the antidote right now from the Record's primetime columnist, Bill Ervolino. Bill, I'm reading the column that you wrote in the Record, and I see you riffing on United Airlines and just air flights in general. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5.
Thank you. How are you doing? When I saw the video, before I even knew what was happening, I looked up and I saw the video, and I thought we had finally caught the Zodiac Killer. So I was very excited to see that. When I found out what happened, I try not to judge. You know, you see a little bit of film. All right, you know everything. I don't know everything. I don't know what happened. But still, I mean, it looked like one of those, man, you know, like the Three Stooges when they're pulling Curly and his head hits like every step. I mean, this guy was like, it was unbelievable to see this.
Hey, he needed triage in his mouth. He's bleeding. He's running back in. He's saying, go ahead, kill me, kill me, kill me.
I just didn't know what to make of it. I think part of it, if I could be serious for a minute.
Sure.
I think that people, they have so many rules at work that they don't think anymore. You know, it's like, the guy's a paying customer. They want him to leave. He was chosen. He doesn't want to get up. Let's think about this for a second. Let's not just drag him out of his seat. I mean, the story was changing rapidly, and maybe I missed something. But, I mean, I still think that this guy's got quite a lawsuit on his hands.
You would think, and the CEO of United Airlines, he's like the Sean Spicer in terms of the many changes that he takes in terms of the – first, he was supporting the flight crew and the security that came on board. This morning, he couldn't have been more apologetic. He was on bended knee.
Yeah, but see, I think this is what I think about the corporate thing. You know, obviously, it's good. It makes money. But, like, people don't think. It's like, this is not the right thing to say. Why are you saying this? You know? And then he realizes, you know, 6 hours later when everybody's jumping down his throat that he has to change it again. But I can't – I have no love for this industry anyway. I only took one flight ever that I liked. And that was the first flight. I was 21 years old. I drove with my buddies to New Jersey, went up in the plane, jumped. That was it. I was up for 7 minutes. It was no problem. I didn't have to worry about where I was sitting or what the food was like. I just jumped out. It was wonderful.
Hold on a second. Bill Ervolino, the only flight that you had a good time on is when you went up there in that prop plane. You're jumping out with the parachute.
This was before they had somebody with you. You had to do it yourself. You had to climb out the door, hang onto the wing. There was like a little, what do you call it, to hold onto like a handle. And I have these big feet, and I'm trying to hold onto this little step. And then you fall backwards, and you fell. And if you live. It was basically, that was it.
And so that gave you great knockers, great enjoyment. But ever since, you'd be like on a normal commercial airliner, whether it was United or JetBlue or American.
Let me tell you, when I was coming back, I went to the Super Bowl in 2008. I think it was 2008, right? The Giants and the Patriots.
Yes.
In Glendale. And so coming home, now I'm in Phoenix. I live in New Jersey, so I have to go first to Seattle, of course, because, I mean, it's right on the way. And then we get on the plane, and I'm starving. And you know how a starving Italian man is. I mean, and the girl's coming down the thing, and she's like, okay, we have this and that. And the third row, I'm sorry, we're out of food. The third row, I'm in like 23 row. I was like, is she kidding? I mean, it's not like I can just go into the next door and get something else to eat. I was like, are you kidding me? But that's it. They do that. Or that. You remember that Gerard Depardieu? I think Gerard Depardieu, the French actor, that they said he got up, he peed on the rug in the plane.
Yes.
As soon as I heard the story, I'm like, prostate. And it's like, they're telling him he can't. He says, I know how this feels. You got to go. They never let you get up. If you got to go, they have no provision for this.
God, you have anxiety when you take flights.
I do. My fear of flying has nothing to do with the flying. It has to do with everything. You got to get there an hour early. You got to take off all your clothes. I bring plastic bags. I put everything in my pockets in plastic bags. I put it in all this stuff. They go through all my baggage. You know, one thing I did coming home, you may want to try this. All my, like, dirty underwear, I put that in the carry-on. They opened it up, and it was like, okay, that was it. They closed it. They didn't want to go through it.
No, totally understood. Not even with the hazmat suit on.
Yes, well, so... But, I mean, they do that. They give you aggravation. I was coming back from Detroit a couple of years ago, and they're yelling at me, the TSA, go on the other line. There's nobody there. I said, I'm fine. I'm the next person. Go on the other line. I went on the other line, and I missed my flight because the people in front of me had a problem with their laptop. A whole thing started, and I'm like, are you kidding me? And that was it. And then I was in Detroit. If you ever go to that airport, it's like... You know, it's like I'm not OJ, you know, running through the airport. I'm like stopping every three, you know, kiosks to catch my breath. It goes on, and I'm running, and I'm like, I'm never going to make this.
I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't have the hard copy of The Record that Bill Ervolino is a columnist for, you got to go online, because he not only makes very poignant comments about airline flights and travel in general, but he gives you a bunch of belly laughs along the way.
Really trying to help our cause.
The Drive at 5.
We're very honored to have him here today.
77 WABC.
To all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles.
Oh, it's like smelling sauce to me on the drive home at 5. As you all know, I made my bones at Mickey D's as the night manager up in the Bronx back in the late 70s. That's where I started the Guardian Angels. You know the rest of the story. And I was always a Big Mac attack guy. That's why I want to tip my beret to two workers at a Mickey D's in Berkeley Township who are probably going to be in trouble. One was a manager, night manager at 19. The other who is a crew member at the age of 21. Apparently what happened is two customers came to that Bayville McDonald's and they were all miffed that their food order was filled out improperly. So they turned on the restaurant workers. They started to punch the manager and started to cut another employee. This is how it all broke down. It was about 11:30 at night and the McDonald's employee crew guy reported to police that the two drive-thru customers complained about their food order and then attacked the manager. In fact, the 19-year-old manager, who police would not name, said he spoke with the customers and offered to credit them for the food on Monday because the restaurant had already closed for the night. But one of the customers then threw the bag of food at the manager's face and followed it up with a punch right to his schnoz. When the manager tried to close the drive-thru window, his hand got slammed in the window and it broke his wrist. Meantime, a crew member, and this is called the closing crew, a lot of people know exactly what I'm talking about because one-third of Americans have actually worked some of their life in fast food, and McDonald's serves 1% of all the food consumed in the world. So we're talking a lot of people out there who know what goes on in Mickey D's. Well, this second employee, part of the closing crew, did not decide to become anonymous or do the bird or not get involved. In fact, all of a sudden, he runs out a side door of the restaurant to confront the customers near their car. Then one of the customers pulls out a knife when the second employee, the 21-year-old man, approaches, and all of a sudden, he slashes the employee on the wrist. They do the bird. They actually burn rubber, and they're out of sight, out of mind. Now, I'm telling you what's going to happen. Mickey D's, at least their central headquarters for all franchise owners and those that accompany stores in Oakwood, Illinois, is going to get very upset. In fact, once the manager recovers from his broken wrist and this employee recovers from cuts on his wrist, they're going to probably want to terminate them because they're going to say, oh, it totally violates the McDonald's employee handbook. Well, let me tell you something out there. These two guys are heroes, and I don't throw that word around lightly because they're from the school that I was trained in. In fact, my mentor was Don Chin,
who was a manager of a Mickey D's up in the Bronx. Oh, he was at East Fordham Road. He was at Kingsbridge. He was at Perry Avenue. He was at 236 in Broadway. He was everywhere. He loved McDonald's. You cut his veins and arteries, he bled McDonald's. But he told me when he was mentoring me, look, I'm training you as a night manager to fight back and to protect yourself. Because in the old days, late at night, we'd have all kinds of hooligans coming in, thugs, gangbangers, dope fiends. And we would keep the hot oil that we were circulating, you know, in the fryer basement right in the filter pump. So if all of a sudden they started to charge the counter, man, they get a splash of hot oil all over them. Or you keep a nice hot pot of coffee and you splash them. And then we had some of our old favorite standbys, butcher knives, yellow handles, of course. And, you know, we'd have baseball bats up above the warmers. You know, it would keep the Big Macs, the quarter pounders with cheeseburgers, all warm as the manager was wrapping all the food up in the bay. And then there'd be that heavily steel grill scraper with the maple wooden handle. And we put a hurting to any thugs who would come into that Mickey D's restaurant in East Fordham Road and Webster Avenue in the Bronx back in the late 70s. Now, that's old school. That was the way I was trained by Don Chin. But I want to tell you, you could have done it the Mickey D's, Oak Brook, Illinois way, and maybe six people would be carrying you to the grave, putting you into the ground for a dirt bath. But if you did it the Don Chin way, you lived to work in Mickey D's another day. Or if they pink slipped you, you'd then be online to get your Max fries and strawberry shakes. But guaranteed, you'd be able to inhale and exhale and look down in your trousers and see that you had big onions and you could drag them around because you were a man's man and you wouldn't retreat, you wouldn't surrender, you wouldn't fold like a cheap camera. Those are my Mickey D memories.